Hello, world. Welcome to the Diversity Hires, the last episode of 2020 for the Diversity Hires. Today, we are going to do sort of an end of the year wrap up, more or less. Just talk about our year, talk about what we think the next year is going to be, what we liked about this year, what we didn't like, which is a lot, and what we're going to do going forward. So I should also add that we are joined by a very special guest, not really a guest, but a member of our family, the Diversity Hires fam, the wonderful August K. Burton is here, AKB.
Hello, everyone.
Oh, my God. I can't believe it. He's back. Anything to add, Shu?
I'm just so glad to have AKB here. That's all. He's like the, you know, shadowy figure who has emerged, you know, like, you know, the one we've all been waiting for.
Nothing more to say. Cue the music. Yo. Welcome to the Diversity Hires, a podcast where Sherman Shu shoot the shit about screenwriting.
We are two working screen and television writers living here in Los Angeles, and every week we come here and we just try to give you the lowdown on the business, the culture, and the craft of writing for film and TV from a distinctly Black point of view. I am Shukri Hassan Tillman, a.k.a. Shu.
I'm your idol, the highest title, numero uno. I'm not Puerto Rican, but I'm speaking so that you know. You already know who it is. The living embodiment of the Courier font, the greatest screenwriter of all time, Sherman Payne. And go ahead, August, get on the mic, bro. Get on the mic.
But where is that one from?
That's before your time, bro.
Way before your time. That's special ed.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's
special ed.
He had the gift of speech, and it's a blessing. So you should listen to the words that he preached.
I love that track, first and foremost. I mean, it's just such a great track. It's a great beat. The opening line, which I just said, is amazing. But my big brother got in trouble for playing me I think Special Ed put out two albums. I think the second album, he got a little more hardcore. And my big brother got in trouble for playing that around me when I was a kid. So it's definitely before August's time, because I was a child when Special Ed came out.
Also, that song, it's great video. Fantastic video. Mm, mm-hmm. Fantastic video. Anyway. You just go look it up, dance moves. It's great.
The only thing I know before my time is Sugar Hill Gang. And, oh, dude. You know,
dude. Oh, that's before everybody's time.
Come on.
I remember going to an Applebee's when I was like 14 years old. Mm-hmm. And I knew the whole Sugar Hill Gang rap, like the hip hop, everything. And you should see me saying this rap with all these white people around, like all of them looking at me, and literally everyone in the restaurant applauds at the end of the rap.
Oh, AKB. Why did you do that? Why did AKB perform the Sugar Hill Gang for an Applebee's full of white people?
Wait. And they applauded. That is the greatest story. And thus began my filmmaking career.
Yes, that was the real start to my career right there. Wow. That was the real start.
That's funny.
You know, we are dealing today, and as we have been for the better part of a year, with a global pandemic, man. And we've been through all the ups and downs personally, you know, professionally. It's really the story that obviously has ruled 2020. But now we're getting back into production, y'all. You know, Shu, you're on a show that's in production. I'm on a show that's in production. All kinds of productions are coming back all over the world. And there was a very interesting story that came up just as we started to record this episode, which is a viral, I think it's the best way to describe it, a viral audio clip of your boy Tom Cruise going all the way in on the crew members of his set for the new Mission Impossible. And, you know, I just wanted to bring that up and talk about it. I want to talk about shooting in the age of COVID, but I also want to talk about sort of set etiquette and the way that he handled the situation. So I'm going to open it up to y'all, Shu. I'll open it, throw it to you first. What did you think of that Tom Cruise rant?
Well, for those who don't know, just a, you can, of course, go look it up. It's about 3 minutes of Tom Cruise responding to a group of crew members who were huddled around a monitor, essentially, and not 6 feet apart, not sort of obeying the COVID rules on set, or at least one of the COVID rules on set. And people should know also that, like, you know, what happens on a film and television set these days is extremely rigorous. Most crew and actors are tested at least 3 times a week,
at least
in some cases every day. There are various protocols that are in place to make sure that people move within certain groups and don't have interaction with other groups, actors not having interaction with, you know, crew members, etc. Lots of script changes that happen in order to accommodate things like less crowds, to accommodate less intimate scenes or where people have to be physically close. There's a lot of different precautions. I just
more
think
exteriors,
that needs to be said.
Shooting more things outside.
Yes.
Yep.
I just think that context needs to be known, that this is not like nobody's jumping into this sort of willy-nilly. This is a lot of work that goes into making all these protocols while the industry was shut down.
Yes.
And to try to get this back on its feet, a lot of things go into it. So I say that to say, like, I think there's a lot of stress and a lot of sort of anxiety involved in all of this. I'm gonna take what might be an unpopular opinion.
Uh-oh.
I didn't have any problem. With the exception of the volume, you know, I had no problem with what he was saying. I felt from listening to it that this was a person who's not just an actor, who's also a producer, and that he was speaking in his role as a producer and really talking about in a, yes, animated and yes, using, you know, a bunch of fucks, but really just passionately talking about the fact that this is everyone's livelihood and you need to take this shit seriously. And that if you're close and you're just huddled around a monitor, it may not seem like a big deal, but these are people's kids and people's livelihoods, their families and their meals in kids' mouths that are on the line. And fuck you for not paying attention to the rules. In this case, now he's not arguing about a performance or about, you know, a director that's giving him trouble or some, you know, other actory bullshit. He's complaining about real life consequences that come from not obeying the rules in a COVID protocol. And in that case, and I felt like he got animated and he got angry, but he also said, listen, I care about you guys. I care about your livelihood and this shit can't go on. I didn't have any problem with it.
Yeah, I had a big problem with it. You're not going to be talking to me any kind of way, man. Listen, watch your tone. Watch your tone. Tone is important. So if I was putting myself in the position of those crew members, here's what I don't know. I don't know how many quiet conversations they had about this beforehand. Perhaps this was conversation number 5, right? Where there were sort of more gentle nudges beforehand, and this didn't just come out of the blue. And in that case, I would fall a little bit more into Shu's line of thinking. But if this was like sort of the initial blow up, I'm not with it. I'm not with it, man. You know, props to Tom Cruise. Please hire me to write, you know, Mission Impossible 10, whatever. But I don't know, man. I don't think you can talk to people like that. I don't think you can talk to grown people like that. And so, had he spoken to me like that, you know, what are you going to do? I don't know. Are you going to sacrifice your job to talk back? And probably not. But I don't know. It didn't quite sit right with me. Now, in terms of the COVID side of things, that I get, you know, I mean, I think that the content of what he was saying was absolutely right, that this is a community problem. So if you care about community, you care about one, your own health and safety, but also your family members, your fellow crew members, the entire filmmaking community, how our industry is looked at, people's livelihood and jobs. I think he was on point about that, but I do think tone matters. You know, I don't know. I don't see a situation where I ever see myself sitting by and getting cursed out by a boss. It's never happened. Never happened. And I cannot see a situation where it does happen.
I have more on that, but I want to hear from August.
Yeah, I think between both of you guys, I understand the sentiment, but how he said it was out of pocket. So I guess I'm more on Sherman's side as far as, like, he said what needed to be said, but he didn't say it the way it needed to be said. And maybe, you know what, I think there are certain times on set or in life where you're communicating with someone and you can only say it a certain way to be heard. But I just can't imagine these as being one of those times. I feel like he could have said it, you know, a lot more respectfully, because we're all adults here. Yeah, so I think how he said it was out of pocket, but I completely agree. And I think maybe I have to also, you know, talk about Shu's point as being like, this is a life or death thing. If you really boil down, like if you really boil it down, it's like not staying 6 feet apart might not seem like a big deal. It might seem trivial to you, but you know, you are affecting, it has bigger implications and bigger consequences. So yeah.
Yeah. I think that's my main point is that, like I said, in the beginning, mm-hmm. The volume and the tone, I agree with you, Sherman, tone does matter. And I think the volume and the tone and the language is over the top. Of course, there's no question about that. Mm-hmm. And there's if you want to criticize it, it's a fair criticism that, hey, man, just take the volume down a little bit, you know, just take the tone down a little bit and you can still get your same point across. And I think that's true. But my main point is just exactly what August said at the end, is that there's probably like two or three things in the world in mm-hmm. which I think it's appropriate to sort of yell and to be a bit out of pocket if you have to be to get your point across. And one of those scenarios is life or death or livelihood. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. That's like the one scenario, one of two or three probably. Another one would any life-threatening situation, I think, can I believe it can. It doesn't require it, certainly not. But I think it can be looked at as like, look, man, it's, you know, we're it may not feel like it, but we're in a war against a deadly thing. And so if the other thing is like, I think you got it. And this is a way bigger thing, but because I do want to get to a story. I mean, look, I have been talked to in a certain way that made me leave a job. And mm-hmm. that's real. But it wasn't about anything sort of life or death. And that's part of the reason why I had a sort of problem with it. But I also think like, look, man, I grew up playing sports. I grew up in I don't want to say anything about my parents, but whatever.
You grew up in a black household. You grew up in a black household, so we already know how your parents talk to you. We already know. Say less.
So yeah. So my point is that like getting screamed at. It's like that at the beginning of that Roots album, if people remember the Dark is Rising, whatever it's called. It's like getting screamed at is not like something I'm going to wither on, you know. If it's appropriate or whatever, or if I could scream back or whatever that is, that's not in and of itself a thing that. Okay. It's like, oh my God, you know what I mean?
I know.
It's
no, not, me either.
Now,
me
if
either.
It's directly at me, that's inappropriate. That's a little bit of a different thing. Hold up.
But Tom Cruise isn't any of these people's daddy, as far as I understand. His kids weren't there. He's not their daddy.
No, but I use the example like a coach. You know, a coach screams at a team. He's not your daddy.
Okay, first of all, he's also not their coach. And by the way,
he's the producer of the film.
If I was, but that's not a coach relationship, bro. That's a professional job in a white collar setting.
Professional coaches. Okay, but listen to me.
Hold up. Wait a minute. if you are a coach of children, then maybe. But I'm telling you something.
Professional coaches scream at professional
adult
teams.
And I have a major issue with that. If I'm 34 years old, if I'm a 34-year-old wide receiver with three kids and a wife and a mortgage, nobody's going to be talking to me like that. Literally, like, nobody's going to be talking to me like that.
But Sherman, because teams, not people. That's a different thing. If you screamed at somebody individually, that's a little bit of a different thing. That's a lot of a different thing, I think. If you get to pull me, Sherman, August aside, said, "You motherfucker, what are you doing? You buzzer." That's yes.
It sounded
way out of pocket.
It sounded like he was targeting.
This was a team.
He sounded like he was targeting two or three people because he even said at the point in the rant, you and you.
Yeah, I don't know.
So it sounded like he was really directing it not at the 100 people on set, but on the three people who he found out by the monitor. Whatever, man. I mean, like, I want to move on to another subject, and I want to hear your story too, but I just would like to say that I don't think that's really ever appropriate in a professional setting. Yes, if you're a parent, you got to sometimes, you know, we all grew up in black households. We know how parents deal with black children, and I'm cool with that. If you're a coach dealing with a football team of 15-year-olds and there's real safety because they're doing something wrong or they're not taking it seriously, I get it. When we're all grown-ups, nah, son, no way. And like you guys say, life or death, but I think that the added element of it is immediacy. Life or death in terms of like you guys aren't closing down traffic, right? So somebody could get hit by a car. Yes, yell, stop immediately. We got to stop. I got to raise my voice to get this thing stopped. If you're talking about onset protocol for a pandemic, it might have just slipped these people's minds. I'm assuming that they're reasonable people if they've made it this far in their life to be working on such a big movie. Probably a quick conversation. A quieted conversation with a stern voice and a stern warning would have set the problem straight. I feel like it's a little bit wild to like get in front of people and start ranting and raving. And part of the reason why I feel that way is because I know as a big black dude that I would never be allowed to do that. I would never be allowed to do that. Wait, that
so
to me
want,
is a
but I agree. But you would want to do that?
No, I wouldn't. But I'm just saying that like. What, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Like if it's inappropriate based on the lens through which we're looking at it from a racial standpoint or a certain group identity standpoint, then it should be totally inappropriate for the 50-something-year-old white dude, even if he is handsome, even if he is one of the biggest stars in the world, even if it is a big production where his name is on the top of the marquee. I think, you know, like either it's inappropriate or it's not.
Yeah, whether you're 6'2" and black or 54 and small and white. I agree. Oh,
you're never getting hired by Tom now.
Well, he's a small guy. I mean, that's not an opinion. That's a fact. But look, can I just say to wrap it up, Sherm, just so we meet some common ground, that I do believe, just to be clear, that it is inappropriate. I'm not putting quotes around it, but it is inappropriate. I just think I was drawing the line between inappropriate and, you know, understandable. And to me, I agree with that
distinction, Shu. It is understandable to a certain extent, but the way that it was carried out, I think, was wholly inappropriate. I agree with that distinction.
Fair.
All right. I mean, you said you wanted to find common ground. I gave it to you, and then you just sort of shrugged it off.
So,
do you want me to retract my olive branch? Should I retract it? Is that what you want?
I said that's fair. I'm holding the olive branch.
All right. Well, I think we should move on and talk about the year that's 2020.
All right. So, yeah, I wanted to, you know, it's the end of the year, tough year, as you mentioned before. Interesting year of transition. But, you know, in all that, even with the pandemic, the election, the crazy person saying that he won, even though he didn't, the, you know, levels of suffering and all that stuff that people have gone through, racial reckoning, all of that, even in the midst of all that, there was some pretty interesting film and television that came out this year. especially on streaming platforms, which everybody's watching. So
yeah,
I just thought maybe it'd be good to talk about some of that stuff and also our own sort of personal writing and, yes. And kind of look in the rearview mirror and see. So a couple questions, and I'm going to start off with something that you mentioned. So this is towards your own personal writing. Let's start with that first.
Okay.
So what new sort of tools or elements or something that you may have learned this year that you were able to add to your work and as you approach things in 2021?
I want to start with a student of our group, AKB, finishing up his last year of grad school at the prestigious USC. AKB, what did you learn this year, man? What did you learn about writing or storytelling that that really has stuck with you and resonated?
This year has been a really important year as far as my screenwriting, because I wrote my first feature at the beginning of this year, and I've been writing, like, I wrote my first pilot this year for a TV show. And I've learned so many things. I don't think that either of them are necessarily amazing or anything. In fact, I think that my feature is, it needs a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the number one thing that I've actually started to incorporate into my writing, which was a really big struggle before, is it was always nebulous as to how to switch between the A story, the B story, or in the C, or whatever stories you have in there. I found that in my writing, I would always stick with the protagonist and just stay with them forever and like never go anywhere else. And I just started studying other pilots, because I was in the world of television classes this year, where we had to watch a lot of pilots and we had to break stuff down. And I was in the writing for animation class where I wrote my pilot. And I finally was able to understand like how to switch between characters. Like, you don't always have to stick with your protagonist or even at this time or going. It was just a very interesting, even though it's like a small thing, it's a big thing to me as far as like, okay, I'm starting to get a little bit better at this thing called writing. So I think that was the biggest development I've made this year.
That, you know what? That's huge, man. Because I actually remember sort of early on in my writing the same thing. The protagonist was in every single scene. And one of the things you learn in TV writing is that it's just sort of it's necessary that you have scenes without the protagonist, because one person can't be on all 8 days of the shoot all day every day, right? Like, you literally have to be able to build a few days, you know, 2 or 3 days centered around other characters, so that your lead number one on the call sheet can get some breaks, because otherwise they will really be going back to back to back to back for like months, and you will burn your character out. It's impossible. So I just wanted to say that hits home with me as well.
Nice. Yeah.
What about you, Sherman?
Okay. I was going to throw it to you, but I'll go. I think we covered this extensively in a previous episode, but this was the year that I feel like I really learned how to pitch. This was the year where I feel like I really, not that I learned how to pitch, because I guess technically I took, a pitching class in grad school. And so I guess technically I learned how to pitch back then. But this was the first time that I found a format and a rubric that worked for me. This is the first year that I found a way of constructing my pitches from a storytelling standpoint that fit with the way that I like to talk about story. And so that was really exciting for me, because it also sort of corresponded with, thankfully, corresponded with a couple of the biggest pitches that I have ever done in my life. And one of them was super successful and one of them didn't sell, but I still feel confident that the way now that I talk about my stories verbally and the way that I can communicate them to producers and executives who might want to buy them has reached another level. And, I would advise everybody, this is the end of the year episode, so it's a good place for me to plug. Go back to old episodes if you haven't. Episodes, I think 5 and 6, if I'm correct, are dedicated towards pitching. You know, we talk a lot about them there. But, really the way that I summarize now my pitch at the top of the pitch with this real extended log line. It's not a log line like the one sentence log lines that people teach you how to do, but it's a real chunk. It's a paragraph, right? It's actually like three or four sentences that really go in depth. And then, as I mentioned in previous episodes, I always like to start with it talking about it thematically. You know, that's something I really unlocked this year, is to hit people right up front. When they ask me what it's about, I don't tell them plot. I don't tell them story. I tell them themes and emotions. And I feel like when I do that, man, it sounds like it's a real important endeavor, right? When you hit people with, oh, my character had to go to the store and then their mom was mean to them. Okay, whatever. But when you tell them that, you tell them, oh, this project is about determination and family and loyalty and secrets. Man, when you start with that, it's like, I can see the Emmys. Oh my God, yo, we got to buy this. I could see the Oscars. I could see the top 10 list. So I really love to do that. I really love to construct a really powerful, and then I follow that up with plot points and story, construct a really powerful paragraph, sort of log line paragraph hybrid that really summarizes things without giving away the ending. And then I feel like, man, I've got them, and now I'm getting into the characters and I'm getting into the world. I'm getting into the actual plot of the pilot or the movie. So this is the year that I felt I've become really confident pitching. That's in no small part to the advent of Zoom pitching. Zoom. I also talked about this in previous episodes, but being able to pitch on Zoom has given me a lot more confidence. I feel less nervous. I feel like it's less of a performance that I only get to do once. I just feel like I'm talking into my computer's webcam, and that's it. And so it's been a good year for me to learn to really incorporate the art of pitching into my professional career.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
That's a great one.
Yeah, I was actually I had to pitch a TV show for my World of TV class. And pitching for me, I have learned a lot of lessons in pitching. I still have a lot more to learn, obviously. I mean, probably a million more. But, you know, I found the biggest lesson I learned in pitching is that you have to be entertaining. Like, I started, my first pitch primarily was a very entertaining pitch because I was just shooting off the hip. Like, I was just saying how I felt about the project. And my professor was like, oh my God, that's amazing. You have to do this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, great. And I prepared something that was very formulaic for the next pitch. And I was like, okay, let me talk about, I need to hit the log line, the characters, how they, the dynamics between characters, the themes, blah, blah, blah. And it was just very, when I said it, it was very textbook. And and my professor said, well, it was a great pitch fundamentally, but like, where was the magic in the pitch? And I'm like, man, you're right. All the magic's gone. And
I struggle with that too. I struggle with that because there is, when though I told this to Shakri too, I might have said it on this podcast, like there is a, when it gets to be formal, I find that it starts to get stiff. The conversation that you have with the executive when you're just sort of like riffing on ideas, you sort of have thought about it a little bit, but you haven't actually made a formal pitch and just talking about which way you would go, that sometimes is actually the better pitch. It's sometimes the better pitch because you're just summarizing in a natural conversation. You haven't rehearsed a performance. You're just talking the way you talk. You're showing your enthusiasm. You're being yourself. And you haven't gotten to the point yet where you've over-practiced, overthought it. You're trying to cram every little bit of information. I understand that. I understand that difference wholly.
Yeah.
Totally. Totally. That's a great point.
Shu, what about you? What did you learn this year, son?
You know, I was... Mine's sort of, I guess, twofold in the sense that it's sort of like two sides of a coin. So, you know, when I first started working on Animal Kingdom, which is a crime drama on TNT, my dad said to me, who I love and is a good supporter of my work, he said to me in a phone call, I just don't see how you're going to be able to do this.
Why?
He said, man, I mean, you wrote on This Is Us. I mean, this ain't This Is Us. This ain't, The Vampire Diaries. How are you going to write a gritty crime drama? You know, how are you going to do that? And I said, you know, I don't know. I think I can do it. Anyway, so I think one of the things for me that I feel like I've gotten better at over the years is being able to sort of boil down, you know, what we talk about a lot, Sherman, sort of the fundamentals of screenwriting and putting stories together. Mm-hmm. And being able to do that and apply that to any genre and any room that I happen to be in or any sort of, you know, type of character thing. So I think I always struggle with a little bit of, you know, vacillate between, you know, extreme confidence and maybe even getting into arrogance a little bit, which is the death knell. Uh-huh. And also feeling like I really can't do anything, you know, sort of going back and forth. Always. So it was in some ways good to reaffirm. And now I've been, two seasons of Animal Kingdom now, and I think it was pretty successful, but being able to sort of affirm my ability to be able to apply those things in a variety of settings and really be a versatile writer. And I think that's been helpful. And I'm about to write a feature, which is I haven't done in so long. And hopefully those skills and those lessons and that confidence will continue as I approach that. But I think the flip side of that is that, mm-hmm. you know, I think the thing that I've also learned is that I've become very good at pitching something that's been brought to me, for example, or pitching in the room or developing stories or writing things that are in other people's world, and as I just mentioned, and being able to sort of be versatile about that. But what I haven't done in too long is write from my own voice. And I haven't really mm-hmm. tapped into the creative sort of wellspring that that's just inside me personally. I haven't really gone to that well. And I don't know if it's fear or if it's just work, busy, two fucking kids. I don't know what it is. But I think that's where I've been seriously, seriously lacking and trying to find a way to get back to that. I don't know if that answers the fucking question. But
well, no, that's that you went into what the goal is for 2021. You got to write your own stuff, man.
I think so. Mm-hmm.
It's funny that you said you're talking about like the transferable skills, right? Like across genres, mm-hmm. across platforms. Maybe this is arrogance. Maybe this is the confidence bordering into arrogance, says the G-Swote. But I always felt like those, yes, man, you know, the foundations, of course, those skills are transferable. Of course they are, right? Because to me, and I know to you deep down, even if you don't phrase it this way, everything is drama. Everything is story. Sure. Right. And so what is a comedy? Oh, it's a drama with funny people and funny situations. What is a crime, gritty thriller? Oh, it's a drama with lots of guns and shooting. What is a sci-fi movie? Oh, it's a drama with aliens and laser beams and stuff. Like the story is always the same, right? You always are going to have a character with an objective and overcoming obstacles. Everything else is just literally genre dressing, right? It's just like, yeah, it's just the elements that make it work. But I always find like when people tell me like I can accept with the exception of comedy, which I think is a specialized art form. Yeah. When people tell me like I can only write sci-fi and I'm like, well, then you're only whack. Like, get out of here. Like, you can't really write. If you can only write one genre, you don't really know how to tell a story. You right. just know, like, oh, the laser beam comes out at 50 miles an hour and will burn through titanium. It's like, shut up. Get out of here. Don't, you can't write. Right. I don't want you around. That's all I got.
I think that's very true. And I knew that intellectually, but yeah. I think in terms of like just learning this year, I learned, I think the application of that is, I guess I learned that it was true. You know, it's one thing to yeah. feel it and know it. And then, you know, to try to actually apply it was a different thing and a challenge and feel like, oh shit, maybe the shit we talk about is actually not just shit talk. It's actually true.
These are real applied. Jewels we're dropping, yo.
Yeah. Real They're jewels. True. Don't explain how your laser beams work in your scripts. That's... When I was writing my sci-fi earlier this year, I remember at one point I just I described in the script like this fictional like weight system that I put in, like this measurement system, and then everyone in the class was like, "Why'd you put this in here?"
I'm writing something. The part of this is self-criticism. I'm writing something right now with laser beams and spaceships and stuff, and you know, it's fun. Like, I'm not shitting on those movies. I like, there are lots of sci-fi movies I like. There's lots of genre stuff I like. But it does sometimes feel like, man, I'm just putting the generic twist on the story to make it genre, right? Like, okay, they gotta, you know, this has to be a battle between two a protagonist who wants something and an antagonist who's trying to stop them. But it can't just be that. I gotta now add, like, what's the technology part of it? What's the advanced weaponry part of it? You know, so it can feel like a little false, but actually think those thrills work and they exist for a reason. So that's at least what I'm telling myself as I continue to write it.
Well, that's a good segue to talk about sort of, let's broaden it out. Let's talk about what television or film did you guys watch this year, that we watched this year, that did all the right things, that, or at least most of the right things, that made you want to become a better writer and mm-hmm. sort of challenge you as an artist. Is there anything out there that comes to mind over 2020?
It's crazy because I haven't watched this year. I watched films from before 2020. Like, I can only mention about mm-hmm. like 4 to 5 films I've watched that were 2020 films. But no, actually, I want to hear.
If you watched it, if you watched it in 2020, that counts.
Yeah, no, okay, that's cool. I want to hear the G-Swelts, what he's about to say, because this year was a big year for him as far as movies, so.
Well, yeah, I mean, shout out myself. I put out a movie, little movie called Charm City Kings, HBO Max, you know how it goes, Sundance winner, okay, all that. I'm sort of like AKB, though. I did not watch a lot of movies this year. Prepping for this episode, I looked at a few top 10 lists where nine times every other year, I would say, I've watched at least 7 or 8 of the consensus top 10 movies. I maybe haven't seen them all. You know, sometimes there's like a foreign film that goes under the radar or whatever. But usually in the past, when I look at a top 10 list, I know a majority of the films and I've watched them. This year, I know almost none. I know almost none of the consensus top 10 movies. And I'm going to blame that on 2020, man. I'm going to blame that on COVID and the theater shutting down. I think I really lost track of movie publicity and when things were coming out. I've often turned on streamers and been surprised that I see a movie on the homepage of the streamer. Like, when did this come out? I never even heard of this before. So I'm like way, way, way behind in movies. I can't even really point to a movie that jumps out at me. And a lot of the black movies are still on my list. Like, I have not watched Small Axe on Amazon yet, mm-hmm. which I really, really want to give my time and attention to. I haven't mm-hmm. watched Chadwick Boseman's last role in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which, mm-hmm. Right, that's what it's called, right?
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. based off that August Wilson play, Viola Davis. I'm super excited about that one. I just haven't gotten to it yet. So I feel like I missed a lot of movies, partially because of, you know, the dumpster fire of 2020, but also because, man, when I sat down at night after a long, hard day of, like, hearing the COVID numbers, all the civil unrest that was going on earlier in this year, it was hard for me to want to sit down and watch a serious piece of art that demanded my attention. I'm just keeping it real. Like, I was much more interested in watching light TV with light stories and sort of not, of course, not frivolous, because I watched a lot of great TV this year, but they were never that deep. They were never ones that required my attention from an artistic standpoint to the extent that a lot of the movies that get praised as the best movies of the year do. So this was a year that I feel like I sort of, like AKB, I sort of sat out of the movie chair a little bit. I do have some TV picks that I really like, which I can talk about, but I'm going to actually punt for now and hand it to you, Shu. What did you watch this year that you liked?
Movies, I'm with you. I mean, you know, I watched Jingle Jangle. That was was good. But kids,
I tried to watch Jingle Jangle. My son was not having it.
Really?
Yeah, it was really weird. I thought he was going to love it. I was into it. My wife was into it. And my son was like, I don't think so.
Wow.
I saw a couple of romantic comedies I liked, you know, as we talked about before, Lovebirds, etc. I mean, nothing that I would say was like, you know, holy crap, this is the, you know, this is the movie. You know what I mean? I didn't see that. I got to be honest, and this is going to sound really weird, but Charm City Kings was one of my favorite things to watch.
Stop it.
The entire, I'm sorry, bro. It was. Stop it. It really was. It really was. I'm giving you the, like, I haven't watched a bunch because, you know, so I don't have a whole lot. I was really impressed with Charm City Kings. I was really impressed with 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Me too.
You know, I just thought it was like one of those films that like stays with you and presented an artist who we know a little bit, Rada Blank. But
come on the show, Rada, please.
Come
on.
Yeah, Rada's got to get on the show. But I just thought it, even because I don't know her that well. So even like just seeing a colleague and someone I had met and just seeing her turn into this, really an art film and really an old school throwback independent New York set film. Yes,
black and white New York.
Yes.
Central character that lives in that environment and feels like the embodiment of that environment.
Yes. Absolutely. That was great. That was great. Yes.
That was a highlight for me as well.
Yeah, it was really good. So
I do
television I have some, so go ahead.
Yeah. Television I have a lot, you know, and again, I watch a lot more TV. I think it's also easier. Those of you who are in committed relationships know that, like, you got to come to a consensus. Like, you're no longer just picking for yourself. Like, especially if you're trapped in the house during COVID, like, you and your partner have to agree on what you're going to watch. So it was always easier for us to sort of agree on television, I think partially because it was a less of a time commitment per episode. So I ended up watching a lot more TV this year, in addition to all the reasons that I already mentioned. I'd say the biggest thing that jumps out for me, and I think it's on the top of a lot of people's lists, is I May Destroy You. Mm-hmm. I May Destroy You was a huge one for me. We talked about this early on. It didn't connect with me at first. You know, it did not connect with me at first. I think that's my fault. I think it's my fault as a viewer because I wanted it to be something that it wasn't. I wanted it to be about a protagonist solving a mystery. Right. Which it sort of, when you watch the first episode, it sort of feels like it might go that way.
Yeah.
And then it became something way bigger, way deeper, way more complex and sophisticated. And I sort of fought against that for a few episodes. But in retrospect, and as I watched the late episodes, I think I just agree with the consensus. That's a masterwork. That's a black woman who is really an auteur doing her thing on screen, and I just found it powerful, and it's only grown in esteem in my mind since I watched it. Like, it's one of those shows where I think back on it, and as I think back on it and I remember moments and story elements, it gets better and better and better the more I think about it, and I'm sure when I watch it again, and I will, that it will be better in the second viewing as well.
I'll piggyback on that and say that I'm going to talk about probably three or four pieces of television, and they are all kind of equal in my book. And I will also say, like, there's also so much television that it's impossible to get to it all in a year. And so there are other shows that I'm sure are great that I just have not had a chance to consume yet. But I May Destroy You is really up there. And there's just something to be said. I there's a lot of things I like about it. I mean, I just, for one thing, I like the respect, and this is a little bit of a behind the scenes thing, but I like the sort of the respect and prominence of the writer. You know, you notice look at the first credit at the end of every episode. I'm not going to give it away, but just look at what the first credit is. Not the UPMs, not the director. Just look at what that first credit is every year, and how at the end of every episode, and how they make sure to frame that. This is a really something that's coming from her voice, her as an artist, and her as a performer also. It's a great piece of work. You know, will it hold up over time? Who knows? But I believe, like you said, Sherm, that, and I think good work has always tends to do that. It tends to sit with you and stay in there for a while. I mean, Citizen Kane was not well received when it first came out either. And it tends to sit in there and mm-hmm. just have you think about it over and over over time and sort of reveal itself to you as an excellent piece of groundbreaking work, which I think it is.
Let me AKB? Add one, like, go ahead, sorry. AKB. Yeah, let me not step over AKB.
Man, I was trying to get out of this one. no, but
AKB's been hitting the books. AKB hasn't watched anything because he's been writing assignments.
Unless you want me to tell you about like what I thought about some 2004 TV show or some like I watched the pilot for Fargo. I really like that, but it's the pilot for Fargo, the TV show on Hulu.
That's one I got to catch up with too. But
let me tell you something. Yeah. Wait! Stop everything.
Stop.
Fargo is one of the most amazing pieces of television ever created. You know, some people, it's an anthology show. Every season is different. Some people like some seasons more than the other. The consensus is that this season 4, starring Chris Rock and with a really big black storyline, was not among the best. But I will say that even Fargo at sort of its worst is better than most TV shows. That show is a hell of a show. And I would highly recommend anybody who likes TV and likes serialized story and crime stories, please stop what you're doing and turn on Fargo. Watch it from the beginning. Watch all 4 seasons. You will not be disappointed. Continue.
Yeah, I think that was my favorite show I watched this year. So I completely concur to what Sherman's point is. So, yeah.
You got a next one, Sherm?
Yeah, I want to add. Let me just say a couple, and then I want to get to the main one, the okay. big one. Some things I enjoyed. One that my wife and I enjoyed, totally silly, real fun, was Pen 15.
I'm so glad you said that. I thought no one else watched it.
No, come on, man.
It's a fantastic show. Fantastic. It's so great,
especially if you at all. It could be again. It's gonna reminisce to before your time because you're younger than us. But if you were at all anywhere in your teens in the early 2000s or the late 90s, Pen 15, whether you're even a little bit old, I think I'm a little bit older than those women who are portraying their childhood, but I still relate, right? Like I was still on AOL Instant Messenger. I still all that 90s and early 2000s, you know, sort of nostalgia that show has. It really hits home, and it's really a well-crafted show. It's well acted.
It's so good.
The storytelling is great. So Pen 15, that was a highlight for me this year. Another one was on a totally different note, was Normal People on Hulu.
Normal People. I did watch that. Yeah.
Normal People. It was good. It's like on the polar opposite because it's so dramatic and it's so heavy, but it's just really, really, really good. So that's another one that jumped out at me this year. But for me, actually, the best show in recent memory, bar none, actually came out at the very, very tail end of 2019. I think it concluded like in December of 2019. So I'm sure that
where are you going with this? Okay.
I'm sure that a lot of people didn't even stream it until 2020 because it came out right at the end of the year. And that's The Watchmen on HBO.
Yes.
Watchmen on HBO blew me away. It is a black show. It does not have necessarily a black creator, but the show itself has so much to do with the dissection of what it is to be black in America, our history, who we are today, how we've been affected by our history, where our lives intersect with white supremacy. And it's done in a sci-fi superhero, you know, against a sci-fi superhero backdrop. And the storytelling is meticulous. The storytelling leaves no thread unconnected. As a writer, it's one of the few things that I watch and I go, I don't know if I could do that because it's so precise, front to back, everything is accounted for. And it's so, so, so satisfying. And I will say that there was a run of episodes in the middle of that season. It's a one season show. It's not coming back. There was a run of episodes in the middle of that show that is like the best consecutive 4 or 5 episodes I've ever seen in my life. Like, each time you think you've seen, because, you know, you always watch a show and you see that one episode, you're like, oh, this is the episode for this season. Like, this is the one episode that we'll remember about this show for this season. It had 5 of those. It had 5 episodes where everyone got better. You're like, how can they top it? How can they have how could they have 5 crown jewels in one season? They did it. So shout out to them. Shout out to Court Jefferson, I think his name is. Black writer, won an Emmy for his episode. But that, I know that's technically 2019, but it happened so late in the year that I feel like I want to lump it into the 2020 conversation.
That's all right. Watchmen deserves it. Watchmen deserves absolutely. It. I feel it.
Sure. So, what did you want to talk about?
My other really big one was what? Was Pen 15.
It was Pen 15?
Yeah. but that's all right. I'm just glad somebody else watched it.
A lot of people watched it,
fantastic.
Man.
Fantastic.
You know, it's funny because in an age where, you know, we have all in the past 15 years, 10 years, we have gotten so used to super serious prestige television, right? Where there's like brooding central characters who are angry and complicated and these intense, sophisticated internal workings that are just serious, right? We've seen that. I love all those shows, right? I love Mad Men. I love Breaking Bad. I love The Wire. I love The Sopranos. All that stuff that sort of gave us prestige TV. Pen 15 doesn't have those elements, but it is a quality piece of work. And so, like, I think that that's why you probably thought in your mind you were the only one who really, you know, because I think it's universally recognized as a great show.
Are you disappointed because I know there are some shows that you watch that you're like, man, I'm the only one who's seeing this. I feel so good. I'm not going to tell anyone about this.
No. I'm actually happy because look, I thought the first season was amazing. And the second season, they came back and I think they only dropped, it might have been a 6 or 7 episode season.
No, it's half the season because they're going to do the other half later.
Because they got
hit by COVID, yeah.
Oh, okay. So what I thought was that maybe it was not being, you know, supported and maybe they were just going to do a short season and not come back. So that's why I feared that not enough people were watching it. And that, so no, I was hoping it would be watched more. I'm just going to rattle off some stuff that I liked.
Go.
That I thought was, you know, maybe not the greatest pieces, but they stuck with me. I liked them. Some of them are, well, I'm not going to call them bad, but they're just whatever. Some things I like. I want to give a little bit of shout out to, I think comedies were just had more banner year than probably anybody. I want to give a shout out to Schitt's Creek, which I thought was a testament to what you do when to keep a show going. The show was not great in the beginning, but kept on pushing until the time that it was a comedy where sort of every scene was really funny and really intricate, and I just loved it. The next one I want to give a shout out to, which I don't know if it's 2020, because if it is, it's the very beginning. I feel like you, Sherm. Shit, it might even be like September 2019 because right. this is blurred so much. Yeah. But I read about it the other day and it made me go, oh yeah, that was a Black Lady sketch show, HBO.
Oh,
I thought
yeah.
just talk about, you know, comedy taking a new tack. I thought all of it was funny and it's coming back, giving it a chance to come back again and really improve on that. It's not something that we've ever really seen before. And I thought it was just great and want to see it continue. This is like, I'm just going to throw this out there because we talked about this, I think, in the first episode. So it's a little bit of a shout out. I'm going to give it to the Great British Bake Off, man. Come on, best show on television. Come on, people. Come on.
I'm not watching. All right. Well, can I be, you know, before we move on and potentially wrap up because we're getting near the end, I want to say what I thought the biggest missing show was from this year, the one that I'm saddest was not present this year. And that is a new season of Atlanta. I really, you know, it's been since 2018 that, yeah, bro, it's been since 2018. I knew that they were going to take a year off, an extra year to get the next season out. I really hoped that it was going to be sometime in 2020. Obviously, the world ended in 2020. So I'm hoping that we get new Atlanta in 2021, because that is, I mean, it's just, it's the blackest show on TV.
That's probably my favorite show of all time, maybe. Maybe. It's,
I mean, you know what? It sounds soon to say that. It sounds soon to put that in there, but it's really that dope. So I cannot wait for new Atlanta.
Because it's two seasons in, right?
Or three. It's been two seasons. There was the first season. There was Robin's season, 2018. And now I think we're looking for the third.
We're waiting for the third, right? Yeah, I mean, first of all, totally agree with everything. One of my favorite shows. A show that has probably lost me a job once, and I'll explain that, because I went to a meeting at a, this is just a testament to waiting for the show. I went to a meeting at a fairly prestigious production company run by a famous person, and I was up for a job there. And there was this book that I had known about and had been reading, and I really wanted to adapt this thing. And they had the rights to this book, so they called me in. They said, oh, well, Kismet. And so we were having a great meeting, and somewhere during the meeting, because I had watched the first season of Atlanta, in the second season, this is back when we had DVR, in the second season I had DVR'd, and I think I had DVR'd maybe like the first five episodes or something, and I hadn't watched them yet, but they were on my DVR. They'd been sitting there for a while. And so we were talking about, I said, yeah, I want this kind of to be a show like Atlanta. You know, this, I think we can kind of go with that tone. And I really love that show. Blah, 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 blah. The guy starts, he's like, yeah, I love Atlanta too. He starts talking about, you know, the season. He said, did you see the season? I said, yeah. I saw it. You know, I really enjoyed it. He said, did you see the first episode with the alligator, right? And I was like, wait, the first episode with the alligator? The fuck are you talking about? It's like, yeah, maybe. Anyway, I thought we were just going to move on. No, don't you remember what happened? And then I realized, sitting in the meeting, I have not seen that season. That season is sitting on my DVR.
Oh, no. How did that lose you the job, though?
It's sitting there.
Did he call you a liar?
He essentially called me a liar at a certain point. And I said, wait a second. I don't think I've seen this season. I'm getting confused with the previous season. And it was like, okay.
There's the door.
Yeah, there's the door, sir.
Please come back. Please come back to us, Atlanta. I think we should move towards wrapping up. The last topic that I wanted to discuss, maybe we could just do a minute each on this. What advice are you giving to writers who are looking forward to next year to start that one big project, to write that pilot, to write that spec feature, to get that first staffing job, whatever it may be? Do you have any words of encouragement or advice? I'm actually giving you guys permission to give advice here. Like, what would you say to people who are getting ready to embark on that next big endeavor, writing wise?
I think the biggest thing is, I'm a big proponent of writing things down as it comes to both one's goals, but also the process by which to get to those goals. And I don't think, I was listening to this podcast with Jerry Seinfeld was actually on Tim Ferriss's podcast. And he was talking about writing in particular. And he was talking about the importance of systematizing that process. And it doesn't matter what the system is necessarily, whatever works for you, but as long as there's a system, and the system meaning that I am going to write from 7 a.m. to 9 a.m. and even if I sit and stare at a blank page, I'm going to do that 5 days a week because that's the time I have, and that's my system. And every day I'm going to have a goal, not whether it's a page goal or just a time goal, that's fine. But that is an example of a system. So I would encourage people to write down what the goals are, define the goals, whether it's to and define the achievable goals, things that are in your control, like finishing your first screenplay or second screenplay or the next one or whatever, or writing a certain amount of days per week at a certain amount of hours, achievable goals, to write those down, define them, and then to develop whatever rudimentary system there is to accomplish those goals. And I think, lastly, Sherman, that we as a podcast, one of the things we can do, and we talked about this a little bit, Sherman, is I think maybe at the beginning of the year, we should go, just like we did with pitching, we should maybe go back and have an episode about writing that first thing. Because what AKB talked about, I think, is so true, is that sometimes it's just as simple as letting people know, like, here's how to do an A, B, and C story in a pilot. Here's how it should lay out. Do you know? It's six beats in the, 2 beats in the teaser, 4 beats or 5 beats in the first act, whatever, however that goes. Right. And let people know that there is a real tangible way that you can try to get these things done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My advice to anybody who's looking to start something new next year and to really accomplish something that they haven't in the past is muscle through. Finish it. Nobody's going to look at your 3/4 of the way script, right? Nobody's going to just listen to your idea of the script you are going to write sometime in the future, right? I always say, I'm sick of you now and later writers. Talk about it now, hope to write it later. I'm sick of that. Just write it. Write it. I'm encouraging you. Just do it. Like that Shia LaBeouf meme.
Yeah.
Just do it. Just write through it. Get it done. It is so much more valuable for you to have something that is imperfect and can be fixed, but that it's done, that there's 100 pages or 120 pages if a feature, you know, it's 55 to 65 pages if it's a dramatic pilot. But just to have that complete thing that says fade to black at the end, do it. Get it done. Don't start and stop. Just finish it, because once you've done it, right? Once you've actually completed it, you've written fade to black. That can never be, it's always going to be done. You can never undo it. You will have a finished piece of work. Whereas if you are always starting and stopping and you have 50 pages of this thing and 40 pages of this thing and 30 pages of this thing, you have nothing. Really, it might as well be zero. So just get it done.
Exactly. I feel that. I actually asked a TV writer earlier in the year, like, oh, how do you get past writer's block? And he was like, you just got to write. You just got to keep writing. Just keep doing it. So I totally agree with that. And that actually helped me. I was like, you know what? Let me just write.
Yeah, I would like to. I'll say that I don't even think writer's block exists.
Neither do I. Right? There is no such thing. Exactly. There's no such thing.
I think it's and this goes back to what I was just saying, AKB. It's a romanticized thing of like, the tortured writer who really can write and really can get things done, but this particular mental block is you're only a writer if you finish stuff. There's no such thing. There's no such thing as a writer who doesn't finish stuff. And we all have challenges. We all need to take breaks here and there. But don't romanticize it. Don't wear it as a badge of honor. It's not cool. No. Finish your script.
Stephen Curry doesn't have shooter's block. he may miss some shots.
Yeah, he may have a bad game.
He doesn't have shooter blocks. He doesn't have shooting block. He goes out and shoots. What the fuck? Yeah, there's no such thing as writer's block.
It's an act. Just do it. AKB, any advice you want to offer? Any? Do you have any distinct perspective from somebody who's still ascending in terms of making the transition from school to professional? Like, is there anything you want to add in terms of advice or encouragement for next year?
Definitely. One thing. Get an accountability partner when you're writing.
Ooh, that's good.
I was just talking to my therapist the other night about, like, you know, she has like high profile clients, and she was just telling me like, oh, the reason why these people's lives seem so together is because they have everyone doing things for them. It's like they have a personal trainer that comes to their house every day and an accountant that manages their stuff and all this. It's very easy for them to be productive because they have these people helping them. It's like if you have an accountability partner, someone to actually help you get the stuff done, you're going to feel, I think the thing that humans fear more than anything else is disappointing someone else.
Yeah.
And if, if you have that entity that will be disappointed if you don't finish something, get that. You need that in your life, you know? So get an accountability partner.
That's a great one.
That's excellent advice.
Yeah.
Real quick.
And get a therapist if you need one, people. Lord have mercy. Get a therapist.
True. 2020, oh my Lord, I needed one for sure.
Yeah, people, seriously. Black people stigmatize sometimes therapy in our community, mental health. We've talked about it on this podcast before, but go get some. I highly recommend therapy. I love it. So go get some if you need some. That's my last piece of advice.
Love it. Before we jump into Don't Do That Shit, I just want to take a second to, you know, a little bit of a meta rant, which is, listen, we need your guys' support for this podcast. We are having a lot of fun doing it. We're about to take a 2-week break for the Christmas holiday, and we'll see you in 2021. But please, please, please share this podcast, rate this podcast, post about it on your social media. If you like it, somebody else will like it too. Shu and I, like I said, we love doing it, but this is really just a side project for us, y'all. We are both employed. We have things that occupy our days day to day in terms of work and income generating projects. AKB, of course, as you know, is a full-time student. He's busy too. And so, like, to really make this podcast valuable for us going forward and to really make it feel like we are doing something that's worth our time and our money, because we're putting our own money into it, we really need y'all's support, and we really need to grow the base listenership of this podcast. So please take the time to share it, to expand the listening audience of this in any way you can. We would greatly appreciate it. And I don't know if you have anything else to add, fellas, but I want to make that plea for 2021.
Amen, Bishop G. Swope. Amen.
Yeah, agreed.
All right, well then it's time for everybody's favorite segment. What everybody fast forwards to the end of to listen to. You know what it is. It's Don't Do That Shit, the portion of the show where we tell you what not to do in order to help you out. Let's get into it. Don't do that shit. AKB, I'll go to you first. What do you got?
Don't write mad camera movements in your script. Like, don't say, oh, and we dolly down to this person, and we zoom in on a 2-shot, and this, all this. And it's always preceded by we do that. It's like almost we is an excuse to put a camera movement. Like, who is we? You're just talking about a camera.
Yeah, you're not a cameraman. Your reader's not a camera. You're not a camera operator. Who is we? You're not on the dolly.
Right? Like, conversely, I just read the pilot for Breaking Bad, and Vince Gilligan had mad wheeze in there, and I was like, you know what? What am I talking about? I don't know anything about this.
Nah, you know what? But nobody's above it. No, listen. Nobody's above it. So, like, props if you are one of the greatest TV writers of all time, but also you can tighten your shit a little bit too. So, take that advice from AKB. Take it. Take it, Emmy winners.
I love that one. This week, you ain't no camera operator.
Oh man, so yeah. Zoom in.
Storyboard artist.
Yeah. Yeah, don't direct on the page. That's the number one thing. Don't direct.
That's a good one.
Don't direct on the page.
That's a good one. You ready for mine?
Go ahead, Shu.
Mine's really simple, as usual. Do not. Ugh, I'm gonna sound like a prude. Do not curse in your action description. It was cute. It had its moment, you know? I feel like people did it for a while for effect because it was sort of unconventional.
Yeah.
It was bold. It was like, wow, you threw a fuck in the action description. What the? You know, fuck or whatever. Look at this fucking thing or whatever. And that's, you know, it had its moment, and I'm not knocking it. I'm sure I've probably done it. But at this point, everybody does it. And so it doesn't have the same effect. It just seems cute.
Yeah.
And cute in not a good way. So I would not do that. Don't do that shit. Just say the words.
There was a parody script that came out several years ago that was floating around the screenwriter internet. I don't remember what it was called, but it was making fun of that. was making fun of these like sort of action, these muscular action scripts that came out. And the first line of that script was fade the fuck in. It was pretty funny at the time, but I do agree that it's been overdone.
It's overdone now.
My don't do that shit for the last don't do that shit of 2020 is don't answer questions in your script that nobody's asking. Don't answer questions that nobody will ever ask. You know, there's a thing in cinema and television and movies called willing suspension of disbelief, which means your audience comes in knowing that they're going to be tricked and they want to be tricked. They're actually suspending their disbelief for those hour or 2 hours, whatever, because they want to be fooled. They want to be tricked. Sometimes I think writers try to overly explain stuff and root it in logic and ground it in our reality when the audience might just go with it, honestly. And when you start to answer those questions that nobody's asking, then the audience will actually start to ask questions because they think that they're supposed to. Quick example, the movie Us, right? By the fantastic storyteller, director, personal hero of mine, Jordan Peele. Love that guy. Get Out was an extremely important movie for me. But if you watch the movie Us, it is this sort of creepy, supernatural horror thriller, you know, social commentary, all that. When you get to the third act, there's a big explainer that tries to root the story in actual science and logic. And I wish that they didn't do that. I wish that that wasn't included in the movie because I wasn't asking any of those questions. I was just going to go through the story thinking it was some strange, weird, supernatural occurrence. Doesn't need more explanation. It's the kind of movie that it is. It's a supernatural thriller. I'm going with it. Some weird stuff happens, and it's not explained by our rules or our logic or our science. And when they tried to explain it and answer the questions that I was not asking, well, then suddenly I started to have questions. I started to actually ask the questions that they were answering, and I found that the answers were sort of unsatisfying. So don't answer questions that nobody is asking. Sometimes it's cool to sort of gloss over things and know that your audience will go with it. That's it.
Cool. That's truth.
Yeah,
that's
I agree with that. You trust the audience to go with your, as you said, your suspension of disbelief. I mean, we are watching a fictional thing. We do realize that.
Yeah, you're asking for holes to be put in, like holes to be poked in your film if you ask questions like in Us, like, how all that worked. Now you have to ask, wait, does that even make sense? Like, does that?
Exactly. Exactly. You were never asking that for the previous, whatever, hour. And now suddenly you're asking it. You know, it's something that we say all the time in writer's room, Shu. I don't know if you have this experience, but, you know, we'll be sort of pitching on something and we'll go down this rabbit hole of like trying to explain it. And somebody in the room will just eventually go, I don't think anybody's going to be worried about that. I don't think anybody's going to be worried about where they got that car from. I don't think we have to explain that they got a new car. I think they just show up in a new car. Nobody will question it. So that's my only point.
Yeah.
You have been listening to The Diversity Hires. You can find us across all social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. We are at Div Hires Pod. I'm your host, Sherman Payne.
And I am Shukri Hassan Tillman. This show is produced by the wonderful AKB. Say what's up, AKB, again.
What's good, everyone?
And you can, like Sherman said, find us anywhere that you find podcasts. And please, 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 like Sherman said, share the podcast. We need more listeners. And you can write to us at thediversityhires.com. You can reach us there or any of our social media platforms to ask a question, suggest a topic, any of those things. We're open to it. But mostly, once again, share this podcast with your friends, with your screenwriting groups, with your professors, with your mentors, with your aunts, with your grandmas, blind, crippled, crazy. It doesn't matter. Just make sure that they all subscribe and listen. And we will see you in 2021. On the next episode of The Diversity Hires.
Peace, y'all.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.